This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Biologist Franz de Waal says that humans are not the only mammals who express emotions that we would associate with ethical behavior, things like empathy and altruism and fairness. He has founded in chimpanzees, capuchin monkeys, and bonobos in the many years he's worked as a primate researcher. He's the director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes Primate Center and a professor at Emory University in Georgia. His new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, is about how evolution has shaped moral behavior from the bottom up. He writes, it wasn't God who introduced us to morality, it was the other way around. Lest you think this is a religion-bashing book, de Waal criticizes the new atheists for their brand of dogma, which belittles religious beliefs. Franz de Waal joins us on Radio Times to talk about what we can learn from our primate cousins, and a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here.
What was the genesis for this book?
Oh, I've always been interested in the origins of morality. I've written about that before, but now I'm mixing in religion a little bit. Because when you say to people, where does morality come from? The majority says it comes from God, or it comes from religion, which I think is a view that is not in concordance with what I think biology would tell you, because our current religions are only 2,000 or 3,000 years old. Our species is far older, and I find it very hard to imagine that, for example, 100,000 years ago or 200,000 years ago, our ancestors had no concept of right and wrong, that they did not punish certain behavior, that they had no idea of fairness or justice. So I find that very hard to believe. And so they must have had moral systems long before we have our religions. And so religion, I think, came later.
But they had these moral systems, as you described, because that was good for survival? It was good for the biology of the species?
Yeah, I think the origin of morality is because morality very often puts the community before the individual. It recognizes individual interests and selfish interests, but it sort of puts a damper on it and says, well, we also need to think about the community and the functioning of our community. And so it actually promotes a cooperative society, and in that sense, it's an adaptive characteristic. Yeah.
Your book is largely about the research on chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest living relatives, but they're different. I mean, these two species, they're different from
these
each
two,
other.
These two are very different. So anthropologists have always preferred the chimpanzee to compare us with, because chimpanzees are aggressive and wage war, and the males kill males in other territories, and they have strong hierarchies. And for some reason, this was very popular because, of course, anthropologists believe that humans advanced as a species by wiping out everybody else. That's actually a problematic proposition because we now know that humans have 4% DNA of our DNA is Neanderthal DNA, which means that instead of wiping out the Neanderthals, we bred with them. And so sex was part of the story. And they tend to forget that, but they don't like the bonobo for the reason that the bonobo is not aggressive, has a lot of sex. And my view is that maybe our history has more bonobo elements than they want to admit, and less chimpanzee elements of violence and so on.
So should we think of bonobos as hippies?
Yeah, they are sort of.
The 60s?
They are sort of the hippies of the primate world because they have female dominance. So they're very popular with the feminist community for that reason. They have lots of sex in all sorts of combinations, so they're very popular with the gay community for that reason. So they are sort of the politically correct primate. But we should not exaggerate because people often think that they have no aggression at all. But the reason they have so much sex is probably partly to keep the aggression under control, and they're very good at it.
So what you actually have in the beginning of the book a description. These are chimps, actually. A chimp, one called Daisy, one called Amos. Amos is seriously ill, but you observe and write about something that Daisy does, and perhaps this helps us understand what empathy might look like, at least coming from a chimpanzee.
So Amos was a very popular male with the chimpanzees, also very popular with us. Actually, he was a beautiful male, but he got seriously ill at a fairly young age. And we put him down like a couple of days later because it was an enlarged liver and there was no way of rescuing him. But he got terribly ill and he was sitting in a caged area, whereas all the other chimps were outdoors and outside. But we had cracked the door to his area so that other chimps could access him. And Daisy, who's a good friend of his, female, she would come over and stroke him and groom him. And he would lean to the crack of the door to have her do that. But at some point she started shoving wood wool towards him, which the chimps used to build nests and to sleep on. And he was not accepting it. And so she started pushing the wool behind his back, between his back and the wall. And very much, it looked very much like the way humans put pillows behind a patient who is in the hospital to make them comfortable. And since Daisy herself is a big woodwool user herself, she loves that stuff, she must have been imagining how he would feel if he could lean back against that stuff. And so she was doing that. And that made me think of perspective taking, because empathy in general, of being sensitive to the emotions of others and caring for others, is not uniquely primate. But taking the perspective of somebody else, sort of understanding how someone might feel under certain circumstances, that gets us close to human kind of empathy.
Well, it raises questions about identity. You know, who am I and who are you? About attachment, about what it is to feel for someone else, and this notion that I am. I won't say somebody. I don't know if I can say that, but that I exist separate from you.
Yeah, so children, for example, when they reach the age of mirror self-recognition, they start to recognize themselves in the mirror. That's the age where their empathy becomes more complex, because at that point they can draw a line between themselves and the other. So instead of fusing with the other, and if you're crying, I'm crying, like babies do that already, which is a very simple form of empathy, they start now to draw a line between themselves and the other, which allows them to take the perspective of somebody else. And there are a few animals, of course, who can recognize themselves in mirrors. We have done ourselves the elephant mirror test. Chimpanzees can do it, bonobos can do it, humans can do it after a certain age. And so the species who can recognize themselves in the mirror, they usually have more complex forms of empathy.
And when they recognize themselves in the mirror, I mean, how do you know that they are seeing themselves?
Well, there's a
test. Understand it. Go ahead.
There's a test for that. Is you put a mark on, for example, for the elephant, we put a big mark above the eye of the elephant so that he cannot see it without looking in the mirror. We put a sham mark on the other side of the head, which in this case is the same substance which we got from the factory without the coloring stuff in it. So we call it a sham mark because you cannot see it, but we still the elephant still feels the same brush on his head and all of that. And so he has two marks. One is visible, the other one is not visible. Then we put him in front of the mirror. Mm-hmm. Put him. With an elephant, you don't do that. You let him go
yes,
in front
exactly.
of the mirror.
Right.
You let him go. And then the elephant touches the mark, which means that he connects what he sees in the mirror with his own body.
Wow. Yeah. Meaning that he is recognizing himself as a self in that particular mirror.
Yeah, yeah.
You've also done some interesting research, I guess, on this notion of fairness. A bonobo pen beshiba. Did I say that name right?
Pan Benicia.
Showed a kind of generosity, I guess, in dealing with treats that she was getting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's purely generosity. What happened in that case, she was being trained for a certain task and getting lots of goodies for it, like M&Ms and raisins and good stuff that bonobos usually don't get. And other bonobos were watching her from a distance that she normally lives with. And at some point she stopped doing the task and she waved her hand to the others until the others also got some of the goodies, and then she continued. And so, yes, you could look at it as an act of generosity. You could also look at it, well, she might get into trouble later on. If she takes all this good stuff and they get nothing, and then later we reunite to bonobos, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's actually, fairness is an interesting concept, because I think fairness is not necessarily regulated by empathy. It's regulated by having good relationships, and if you have a fair distribution, it's easier to maintain them than if you have an unfair distribution.
And because I called it generosity, are there also risks of ascribing certain traits that we would think of as human traits to, in this case, to primates?
Well, I tend to take the position that if an animal is very closely related to us and does similar things under similar circumstances, we have to come up with a similar concept to explain it. So I know that there are psychologists and people who work on animals who are very conservative in their terminology and say we should avoid anthropomorphism, which is fine if you see, for example, fish doing something similar to humans. Yes, there's probably a different explanation for what the fish are doing. But a chimpanzee or bonobo is as close to us genetically as a horse is to a zebra. Now, if a horse and a zebra do similar stuff under similar circumstances, we're certainly going to come up with a similar explanation for it. And I would apply the same rule to human and primate behavior.
We put on our Facebook page, one of your greatest hits when it comes to animal behavior. And these are two capuchin monkeys. One is given some cucumber. The other given a grape. And I recommend that people go to our Facebook page and look at it, because it's not only very funny, it's very revealing. Tell us what's going on.
The reason we
here.
Humans find it so funny, because people always laugh, and
yes,
the clip has been the clip has been advertised as a hilarious experiment. The reason people laugh is because I think it makes them slightly nervous to see that animals have very similar feelings to themselves. So there is an element of nervosity in it, which I don't mind. What we did with the capuchin monkeys is we put them side by side, and we have them do the same task, a very simple task. And if you give both monkeys the same reward, let's say you give them both grapes or you give them both cucumber, they're perfectly fine doing it 25 times in a row. Right. But if you do different rewards, one gets grapes, and grapes are much better than cucumber slices. So if you give one of them grapes and the other one cucumber, the one who gets cucumber is very upset about that and gets very agitated and refuses the task and actually starts to refuse the food. Which is an irrational thing, according to economists. You should always take anything you can get, but they start doing that, and so that's a sense of fairness. When we first published that, we got letters from philosophers, because philosophers had written whole books about the sense of justice and the sense of fairness and how we reason ourselves to moral principles and stuff like that, and they couldn't stand the idea that a monkey would have that same sense. And so we got letters from philosophers who said it's impossible because the sense of fairness was invented during the French Revolution, and so how can monkeys know about this and stuff like that? But now we have gone much further even, because the monkeys have a very egocentric sense of fairness. I mean, they care about getting less than somebody else. But with chimpanzees, we have now the point, which is a bit similar to the Panbanisha story, where chimpanzees will refuse the better reward if the other one doesn't get the better reward also.
And we're almost having a break here, but what's interesting about the capuchin monkeys is the one who's upset is the one getting the cucumber. The one getting the grape doesn't seem to be bothered by this injustice or unfairness at all.
Yeah, but in chimpanzees, it's just so it's the grape owner who also gets upset.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Frans de Waal today on the show. He's a biologist, a primatologist. In fact, he is the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center, and also a professor at Emory University, a professor of psychology there in Georgia. And he's also the author of a new book called The Bonobo and the Atheist, and it's subtitled In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Give us a call. Any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Guardian Nurses Healthcare Advocates supports WHYY. Serving the region for 10 years, these registered nurses accompany individuals to doctors, help get second opinions, and help with insurance claims. GuardianNurses.com. Guardian Nurses, lighting your way through the healthcare maze.
PIFA, a Kimmel Center production, supports WHYY and presents City Tavern's Chef Walter Stabe in A Taste of History, Saturday, April 13th at the Kimmel Center. On the 270th anniversary of Thomas Jefferson's birth, Chef Stabe embarks on a culinary adventure, celebrating the food and history of our founding fathers. Jefferson, Washington, and Adams leap out of the history books and onto the stage. Lead sponsor, TD Bank. Tickets at PIFA.org.
Hello, this is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I am coming to Philadelphia to do this show that I know sounds completely ridiculous, but I swear is pretty great. It's a collaboration between me and the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company. So I tell stories, they dance, two art forms that have no business being on stage together, April 20th and 21st. We did 10 minutes of the show at Carnegie Hall and brought down the house. WHYY members get discounted tickets at whyy.org/events.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Franz de Waal is our guest. We're talking about his new book called The Bonobo and the Atheist. He writes that morality comes from evolution, from the bottom up, not the top down, if you will. We're talking about what we can learn from our chimp and bonobo cousins. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. There's a picture in this book here of two chimps kissing mouth to mouth. Mm-hmm. Is that affection? How do we understand? What do you think is going on in that picture?
That's usually when they greet each other, when they reconcile after a fight. So yes, it has a similar meaning as in humans. It probably comes from food transfer between mother and offspring. In apes, that happens, that the mother is chewing stuff and then transfers it to, and that's also where the tongue comes into, tongue kissing.
Right.
You know, I think that's the origin of it.
So, can we say that chimps and bonobos that they're moral creatures?
I wouldn't call them moral, and I've never called a chimpanzee or bonobo a moral being in the human sense. I think they have a lot of the ingredients that we have built into our moral system, such as caring about others, caring about rules, following rules, punishing those who deviate. All these things can be observed in them, empathy, sense of fairness, and so on. But to have real morality the way we do, there's additional elements. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we reason about and we try to justify why we have certain rules. And we try to seek consistency. We have a discussion about whether if you're for the death penalty, you should be for abortion, or the kind of discussions we have. And so that sort of thing, of course, doesn't happen really in chimpanzees mm-hmm. and bonobos. And we also try to objectify these rules. And so the moral rules that we live by, we, for example, I live by, you live by, we feel everyone in the world should live by these rules. And so we think that the rules are universal, and I don't think chimpanzees particularly care about that issue.
At least not yet in their evolution. But it also seems, and you had mentioned philosophers earlier on, that not that you're challenging this notion about the sort of logic of ethical or moral behavior, but saying it's so much more than that, that we have to include biology mm-hmm. when we understand about ethical moral behavior.
Yeah, so what happened is that at first moral rules came from God and came from religion. And then after the Enlightenment, the philosophers said, no, we don't necessarily need God, but it comes from reason and logic. And so the philosophers had a prominent place in providing this reason and logic. But it's still a top-down view of morality where you say, humans don't really know how to behave. Someone ought to tell them how to behave. If it's not to the religious leaders, it's going to be the philosophers who's going to tell them. But I'm much more of the school, which is very popular at the moment among neuroscientists and biologists, of a bottom-up view of morality, where we say morality comes out of interactions and social tendencies between people, sort of consensus building among people of how we should behave. And the top-down normative features of morality, which do exist, they come sort of secondarily. Yeah. Yeah.
But are you also saying, I mean, there is this, and you write about it in the book, this veneer theory of morality, the idea that underneath us we're just wild, you know, a cauldron of nasty tendencies. I think I'm quoting you there. That's a view of human nature, is that we're essentially bad, mm-hmm. And we have this overlay of morality that forces us to be good.
That's a view that was actually popular in biology. It was not a Darwinian view, but during the 70s and 80s and 90s, biologists such as Richard Dawkins and Robert Wright and other people, they started promoting this view that we are inherently selfish and competitive, and there's really no room for moral evolution. Just like Huxley, who was a contemporary of Darwin, who also saw no room for the evolution of morality, the biologists sort of talked us into this corner where, on the one hand, they said evolution cannot explain morality, we don't believe in religion, well, then there's nothing left. If biology and religion are not there, then I don't know how you would ever explain the reason we have morality. And so Darwin saw this problem, recognized this, and Darwin proposed that evolution can produce these moral tendencies. Now, the veneer theory is basically the idea that we are so 100% selfish that we can never overcome that, maybe only culturally or religiously, and that we naturally don't have any tendency to be good or nice to others. Mm. Now, this whole thing is now sort of forgotten, because after the year 2000, the economists started to find that we are much more cooperative than they thought. Then the neuroscientists found that if we give to charity and do nice things, there's pleasure centers in our brain that light up, meaning that we take pleasure in being nice to other people. Then primatologists such as myself said, well, a lot of our close relatives, they have actually genuine altruism going on. And the anthropologists started playing the ultimatum game all over the world and finding sense of fairness in all people of the world. Around the year 2000, the whole veneer theory collapsed and is now nearly forgotten 10 years later.
We just had someone on the show who was talking about givers and takers in the workplace, mm-hmm. and looking at research saying that strategic givers tend to do very well in the workplace, and not the doormat givers, but the ones who are kind of thinking strategically but also generously. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. And with chimpanzees, since we do a lot of experiments on pro-social behavior, I think there is a strategic element. So a typical experiment that we do is we have one chimpanzee can choose between two tokens of different colors, which they can exchange for food. And so one color gives only food to themselves, the other color gives food to themselves and a partner who sits next to them. Now, guess which one they prefer? They prefer the second one, because they prefer the outcome where the partner gets something also. So that's a pro-social tendency. But I do believe that in chimpanzees, very often these givers, so to speak, they have all sorts of strategic goals in mind. And so it's not necessarily purely pro-social what they're doing.
But it is also true that there's violence among chimpanzees. It's not as if they live a benign life. I don't know if that's so true in bonobos.
No, but you know, my first book was Chimpanzee Politics, which was all about power struggles and violence and fights and coalitions and stuff like that, very much like Washington, basically. and so I'm very familiar with that. And even though at the moment I often emphasize the nice side, the pro-social, the morality and so on, there would be no reason for morality in human society if we were purely nice. You realize that if we were 100% friendly and nice to each other, there would be absolutely no reason for a system of rules. And so it exists to a large degree because there are conflicts in society.
Let me reintroduce you. And again, Frans de Waal is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a biologist, a primatologist. He's been doing research for many, many years now, and the author of a new book called The Bonobo and the Atheist, and it's subtitled In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. He's a professor at Emory University, and he's also the director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center. That's in Georgia as well. Mm-hmm. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So are you saying we don't need religion in order to behave morally?
Well, that's an open question to me. So I'm personally a non-believer. I call myself an apatheist. You know, you have the agnostic who doesn't know if God exists. You have the atheist who knows that God doesn't exist. And I'm actually not interested in the question of whether God exists, because we will never resolve that issue.
Apathist, meaning you don't care.
I don't particularly care about that issue. I think it's an unresolvable issue. And I do care about the question, why do all humans in the world have religions? Why do all humans in the world believe in the supernatural? And as a biologist, you would tend to say if something is universal, it probably provides advantages. That's what we usually think.
Right.
And I don't see much of a parallel with primate behavior here. I think religion is typically human. And the thinking here is that the moralizing gods that we have came into play when societies got too big. So in a chimpanzee or bonobo society, everyone can keep an eye on everyone. In our ancestral societies, probably also. We knew everybody. We knew how they behaved. We would punish them if they behaved wrong and stuff like that. But if you get a society of several thousand people or several million people, that whole system collapses. You cannot keep that going. And that's maybe where our current religions being very young, but maybe they came in after our societies got so big.
But sort of rules based on this sort of biological morality that was there At the beginning?
That would mean that the morality, the source of morality is not religion. The source of morality is our social existence as a species, basically. And our religions were sort of added onto it. And so if you ask, can we be moral without religion? I think individually, there's lots of people who can be moral without religion. I'm convinced of that. But as a society, that's sort of an open question. And in Northern Europe, I'm from the Netherlands, in the Netherlands, 60% of the people say they're non-believers, and I think it's still a very moral society. So in Northern Europe, we're doing the sort of the experiment to see if you can build a society like that without religion.
But, I mean, it's interesting to think that you need religion or rules and regulations as a society gets bigger. But do you think there's also this impulse to be to especially living on the earth as we do, looking up and seeing this universe that we're in, to think in those sort of large, abstract, godlike terms.
Yeah. To be connected to the universe, I think we scientists, the reason many scientists are agnostic or atheist is partly, I think, because science fills that hole for us. It because our science connects us with a lot of things, and we have, of course, usually a very specialized area of something like chimpanzee behavior or something very specialized that we do, but still that connects us to the larger whole, and we have that feeling of connection that maybe other people derive from religion. So that's a very interesting sort of parallel there.
But you also say in this book is that science doesn't, I think I have this right, that science doesn't tell us how to live. Is that true?
No, science is not in the business of doing that. So science is in the business of explaining how things operate, where things come from, sort of the behind-the-scenes explanations of our reality. But science is not in the business of telling you how to live your life, or why you are here and why you should be good or bad. Science is not in that business at all. That's not its task.
But I have to say, having interviewed a lot of scientists, it seems that those are the issues that most concern and enthrall them.
Mm-hmm. You mean how to live your life?
Well, sort of, what are we doing here? I mean, how did this I mean, if you ask questions about how did we get here, it seems it naturally leads to questions about, then what is my life about? What do I owe you?
Yeah, but do they provide you answers? They may ask the question and wonder about it, and who knows, they may be wondering even more about it than other people in the world, because they're scientists and they wonder about everything. But do they provide answers? That's the question.
Yeah. Were you always an apathist, as you say?
Uh-huh.
I mean, even as a kid?
No, I was raised Catholic, and so until I left home, I was raised Catholic, and then when I became a student and left home, all of a sudden I dropped it. I was actually never quite religious, I think.
But it's just this whole notion of is there a God, isn't there a God, do I believe, do I don't believe?
That was
just not even...
That was not my issue, no. My issue was more like how do you lead your life, why are you on earth? But I didn't seek the answers in religion for that, no.
You mentioned some of these neo-atheists, and I guess we should name names here. We're talking about the late Christopher Hitchens. I have to say I interviewed him several times. Richard Dawkins, another one I've also interviewed several times. But you're pretty critical of them and call them out in this book. How so?
Well, I think they have reached a noise level, so to speak, that makes open discussion almost impossible. So if you present the atheist as rational and the believer as irrational, as has been done explicitly by these people, then basically you call all the believers idiots. You're basically telling them, you're idiots, I cannot talk with you, and until you drop your belief, but as long as you keep your beliefs, I cannot really discuss science with you, because science also belongs in the rational side of things. So I meet a lot of religious people who are quite undogmatic about it and who are open to science. And I think you're turning these people away. If you tell them you need to drop all your beliefs before we can even discuss the theory of evolution with you, then you're sort of turning them away because you're telling them that they are not worthy as a debater or a discussant. And I feel in my book, there's two groups I need to get sort of out of the way. One is the biblical literalists, because I really don't know what to do with them if you talk about the evolution of the human species. But that's maybe one-third of all the believers in this country, and the atheists, the very vocal atheists, because I think they have reached a shouting level that is not really conducive to debate. And if I push them out of the way, I can have a sort of open discussion about why do we have morality and where does religion fit into the picture.
In fact, you say that dogma or dogmatism is a greater threat to science than religion.
Oh yeah, I really don't like dogmatists because they're not open to changing their mind and they're not opening to listen. That they actually don't listen ever to you. And some of the atheists have become dogmatists in the sense that they know everything. And I personally know very little, but they think they know all the answers.
You say you personally know very little?
I think I know very little, yeah. And I think you should always be open to new opinions and new insights. And if you're not, then you're a dogmatist, yeah.
You write, neo-atheists are like people standing outside a movie theater telling us that Leonardo DiCaprio didn't really go down with the Titanic. How shocking. I mean, you're saying they're literalists? They don't understand a certain kind of imagination?
Yeah, so if you say, I'm going to disprove that God exists, of course, many people who believe in God, they know that God is a character that you can never prove its existence of. It's called faith. It's not knowledge. It's faith, you know, that you have. And so in the same way, when we go to a movie, we believe all this make-believe stuff that is made up there in Hollywood. We temporarily, for 1 hour, 1.5 hour, we believe all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, in the back of our head, we know it's made up. And when we walk out of the theater, if someone tells us, do you know you cried for someone who doesn't really exist? Of course we knew that.
You also say that religion, both religion and science, have done bad, even evil things, or things have been done in their name, bad things.
Yeah, to say that religion is all bad and that science is all good, that's a very naive position. So, for example, Hitler, he was inspired by eugenics, which was a scientific theory, a serious scientific theory at the time. So he did a lot of bad stuff in the name of science, so to speak. He didn't talk much about religion. He was not a particularly religious person, I believe. And so to say that science always produces good things, science produces nerve gas and atomic bombs, and I'm not saying that the scientists who produce it are necessarily to blame for what happened, but it's naive to think that science only produces good things and religion only bad things.
And vice versa, I guess.
Because it's a very sort of, well, religion, who is having soup kitchens in the centers of cities? It's not the atheists, you know. That's the churches who do. And so religion, to call religion all bad and producing nothing good, that's not particularly right either.
We're almost up in a break here, but do you just based on what you said, do you think atheists should organize their own unreligion so they can open kitchens?
Well, atheists are just a spectrum, just like the believers. In believers, you have the dogmatists and the open-minded people. And I think in atheists, there's a lot of atheists who don't particularly, like me, who don't particularly care about being an atheist, who don't take that as a dogma.
Well, let's take another short break and get back to our conversation and also get some callers in. We've touched on a variety of different topics. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Franz de Waal today on Radio Times. He's a primatologist, a biologist, author of a new book called The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School, with day and residential options, is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
Just you wait. WHYY's program about popular culture brings you stories about our changing world, like trying to stop teenagers from ruining their digital lives, practical tips to ready yourself for the end of days, and how we sent one of our reporters to space camp and it nearly killed him. Okay, he just blacked out a little. Still, pretty cool. Those stories and more, just you wait.
Saturday at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Prokofiev wrote his Fifth Symphony as a hymn of hope for Russia and its people facing their greatest challenge. Conductor Yap von Sveden leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in Prokofiev's Fifth and music of Tchaikovsky, The Souvenir de Florence. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Friday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Franz de Waal. He has spent his career studying primates, and he's director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes Primate Center in Georgia, author of a number of books about primate, the first one called Chimpanzee Politics. More recently, he's been focusing on emotions, things like altruism and fairness and reciprocity and kindness. He wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Age of Empathy, and he's got a new book called The Bonobo and the Atheist, where he writes that morality comes from evolution, from the bottom up, not top down. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Wallace to join us. And Wallace, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you. This is Wallace Wolf. By the way, my son works at Emory in the psychology department, the Philip Wolf. You may know him.
Yeah, I know. He's a colleague of mine. Yeah.
There you go. Go ahead, Wallace.
All right. Anyway, one of the distinctions that I have heard between primates and humans is the question of the word why. Humans worry a lot about why things happen. And that's a big distinction, I think, with humans between primates. They deal with this question of why a whole lot. Any evidence that primates ever wonder about why something's happening?
Oh, Wallace, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
Yes, I think we have done experiments. Actually, the experiment that sticks in my mind was done with crows, not with primates, but it's an experiment where something moved and it could not normally have moved, but either you would see a hand with a stick that pushes it and so it moves as a result of action, or you would see no hand with no stick and the thing moved sort of spontaneously, and the crows were suspicious of the second object more than the first. And I think that sort of experiments is done where you look at cause-effect relationships and see if animals wonder whether the cause-effect relationship is understandable or not. So I'm not convinced that the why question doesn't come up with other animals.
Wallace, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Your book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist. Mm-hmm. And you have at the very end, what would a bonobo tell an atheist? Expand on that. I found that an interesting section.
And actually, in that discussion that I put at the end between the bonobo and the atheist, the bonobo grants a lot of ground to the atheist.
He's very nice to the atheist.
Yeah, he's actually very nice to the atheist. And so I don't think atheists should be too upset with my book. But the bonobo basically says, slow down on that question of whether God exists or not. That is not really the interesting question. He says the interesting question is, where does morality come from? And then, of course, the bonobo also explains that we shouldn't look too much at social insects, which has been done so much, but they don't have the empathy mechanism. They have lots of altruism, which is probably achieved in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not denying that they are not they're perfectly cooperative and altruistic, but they don't have that empathy mechanism that makes you respond to the distress of others that all the mammals have. And so that's what the bonobo tries to explain about it.
What would a bonobo say to a fundamentalist? Have you thought about that?
To a biblical literalist, you mean?
Yeah.
He would say, well, close the book for a while and start thinking about the world and look at the evidence. You know, that's, I think, what he would say. It's a bit harsh, maybe, but I think that's what he would say.
What got you interested in bonobos? As you said early on, people were looking at chimp behavior, and bonobos are more, I guess, recent development in the world of research, primate research.
Yeah, so bonobos were discovered much later than chimpanzees, and they live in pretty inaccessible forests in Central Africa. And so as a result, we know much less about the bonobos. And since they came later, there has been a tendency in anthropology to focus all the attention on the chimpanzee. So when Ardipithecus was discovered just 2 years ago, they were making all these comparisons with chimps and say, well, Ardipithecus looked quite different, was a much more peaceful creature because it had small canines. They forgot completely about the bonobo, who, in terms of body proportions, looks exactly like Ardipithecus, has reduced canine teeth, is peaceful. So the anthropologists need to learn how to pay attention to to bonobos.
In fact, you have a picture of humans and chimpanzees and bonobos, I mean, drawings here, and you can see the physical connection between bonobos and humans.
Yeah, you can see that, and because bonobos have longer legs when they stand upright, and they walk upright quite a bit, actually. So that's another thing, of course. Anthropologists long have emphasized how good humans are at walking bipedally, but bonobos are actually quite good at that.
I'm curious about what you see if you go to Central Africa and you see bonobos in their natural habitat and what you see at Yerkes.
Well, it's very hard in the field with bonobos because they live in dense forest and high up in the trees to see all the details of the behavior. And that's why a lot of our studies on bonobos we do in Kinshasa. There's a sanctuary where they receive orphan bonobos because there's unfortunately a lot of bushmeat trade in Africa. So they shoot the adult bonobos and they try to sell the babies on the market live. And the babies are then confiscated, brought to the sanctuary where they're raised. And we do a lot of studies of consolation in those bonobos. So the consolation is when someone has lost a fight and is screaming, and how others then approach and calm them down and groom them or have sex with them in the case of bonobos. And what we found, one of the things we found is that mother-reared bonobos, because there's quite a few there who are raised there by female bonobos, mother-reared bonobos are far more empathic in this kind of situations than the orphan bonobos. It's very similar to the story on Romanian orphanages, where they study human orphans and find that they are emotionally very disturbed and they don't show a lot of empathy responses. So the same thing we're finding in these bonobo studies.
And my memory of those Romanian studies is that these children, they weren't even sort of hugged or cared for, and that was in part an explanation about why they were so troubled.
Yeah, that's part of the story of American behaviorism, Skinner, you know, and Watson. They had this idea that children should not be hugged and cuddled and kissed. Children should be just rewarded and punished whenever that was necessary. And that has been applied in orphanages, like in Romania, and that's the result that you get is total emotional disturbance.
Yeah, marasmus, failure to thrive. Yeah. Why would someone then kill a mother or father bonobo and then sell their orphan child?
Because the orphan child can bring a lot of money.
And who are they selling to?
Well, there's probably owners who want to buy it, or maybe even zoos still, even though Western zoos would get in deep trouble if they would bring in illegally a bonobo, but who knows where they're going.
Yeah. Let me get looks like Liz from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Liz, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there, and it's been a pleasure listening.
Thanks.
Thank you. My question is going back to religion and morality in the animals versus humans. He had it explained to me once, which made sense, and I was, you know, like 12 years old when I heard this, and I never forgot it, that humans adapted religion only because of their egocentric mind, the ability to understand the self and question the future. So therefore, they can't believe that they would cease to exist. So they create religion, whether, you know, it's God, whether it's, Buddhism, reincarnation, that kind of thing, because they're egocentric, whereas an animal does not have that ability to kind of ponder their future.
That's interesting. No, Liz, thanks a lot. That's an interesting comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in the book, I tried to explore a little bit the question of mortality.
Yes.
And I first document how primates and other animals react to the death of somebody else. I do think bonobos have an understanding, and chimpanzees also, if someone dies, that it's permanent, that they're very silent, they stop eating, they're very much affected by the death of somebody else, and sometimes they don't eat for days afterwards. But whether they can extrapolate from seeing that to themselves, that we really don't know. We don't know if a bonobo or chimpanzee realizes at some point this could happen to myself. And humans do, of course. Humans know about their own mortality. And that is sometimes brought up as a reason why we have religions. I don't think it can be the full explanation. But I think it's part of the story is that, of course, many religions believe in an afterlife or in karma or that kind of things. And so it is part of the story, I think, of religion.
Liz, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You include in this book a drawing, and underneath it says, Dorothy, a 30-year-old female chimpanzee, died of heart failure at a sanctuary in Cameroon. Staff brought her out in a wheelbarrow to display her body. The normally rowdy chimps gathered around staring at the corpse and holding on to each other. They were as silent as people at a funeral.
Yeah, that's based on an actual picture that you can look up on the internet. It's a very striking picture. And I've seen chimpanzees go completely silent after the death of a chimpanzee. They also try to rouse the body, actually, which humans used to do in the old-fashioned funerals. They try to activate, which seems like a logical reaction because maybe you can revive the individual. They don't know if the individual is permanently dead or not. A story that I describe in the book which I thought was sort of amusing, which was bonobos who had found a terrible snake, and they were very scared of it, and they were poking it with sticks and not touching it until a high-ranking female grabbed the snake by the tail and swung it around and killed it very deliberately. And once it was killed, within minutes, all the chimps sort of gathered, and then they draped it around their neck. They ran around. The juveniles looked at the teeth of the snake and all of it. It was as if they fully understood that dead is dead. This thing is not going to come back.
It's not a threat.
Cannot be revived. And so that gave the impression of the permanency of death, really.
Let me see what Jim from Levittown has to say. Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I'm wondering, first of all, if you're familiar with the role of mirror neurons in primates, mirror neurons being discovered, within the last 10 years or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And in particular, the mirror neurons, according to a guy out of Stanford, René Girard, who believes that mirror neurons lead the primates to imitate each other.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And in particular, imitate each other's desires. So one monkey wants this banana, the other one wants the banana as well. Not so much out of a biological need for hunger as imitating, as just copying the behavior. Mm-hmm. And this leads to rivalries. According to Girard, this leads to violence. It leads to violence in human communities. And because of these rivalries, we have a hard time holding ourselves together. And the only way this is resolved, according to Girard's theory, is by everybody in the society ganging up on one particular victim. And that allows the society then to form a bond over against the victim. And so I'm wondering...
Well, you know what, Jim?
Let me say a few things.
If you see any scapegoating behavior
a few things about
it. Go ahead.
First of all, mirror neurons were discovered in Italy in macaques. And mirror neurons are now very often invoked to explain empathy and imitation. So, for example, if you talk with a sad person, your face will automatically assume a sad expression, your body will have a sad posture, and you will start feeling sad. And so that's how we think that these motor neurons, which is basically what they are, that bring you in contact with the other person, may lead to empathy. So that's one side of the story, and people often forget when they talk about mirror neurons and empathy that they were discovered in monkeys, and the evidence is far stronger actually still for the monkeys than it is for the humans. The second thing about scapegoating, yes, I know Girard's theories on this, and scapegoating is a very common primate thing. And so, for example, in primate groups that are unstable, especially when they're newly formed, if we form, let's say, a monkey group, you get very often an individual at the bottom who gets all the frustrations and irritations on its neck. It's a very difficult position to have, but if you remove that individual, someone else will get into that position, and you just have to wait till things stabilize for that to disappear. And, of course, in a stable group of primates, we have many of those too, there are basically no scapegoats. For example, in our groups of chimpanzees, there are no individuals who are in that particular role.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You had a piece not so long ago in the Wall Street Journal, the headline, The Brains of the Animal Kingdom, where you write that we have tended to, I guess, under value or not understand the intelligence in animals. I haven't really put together the kinds of tests that would tell us just how smart an elephant is or a primate is. And you went to the National Zoo, and there's an elephant that you saw, Kandula, a young bull elephant. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yeah, so we always assume that these animals can do things that we can do. And so with the elephants, they had tested tool use with elephants by putting some food outside of their area and give them a few sticks and say, are they going to use the sticks to get the food? A chimpanzee would immediately do that, would not hesitate to do that. But the elephants never used any sticks. And so the conclusion then was the elephants don't know how to use tools. And that's very often. We do the wrong test on animals, and we have negative evidence, and then we say, well, they miss a capacity which is essential for us, but they don't have it. And then one day the investigators, they tested the elephants very differently. So they hung some food very high up, and they gave the elephants boxes. And immediately they started using this stuff. They moved the boxes underneath the food, and they would stand on the box, and then they could reach with their trunk to food. And the thing with elephants is that their trunk is their smelling organ, and so picking up a stick is not something they like to do because they shut off the smelling organ. And increasingly, we are now doing tests, and we're increasingly successful with this, tests that really apply to the animal, that take the animal into account. For example, chimpanzees were tested on face recognition by presenting them human faces, and they were doing very poorly on it. And I talked with the investigators who did it, and they said, well, of course, human faces are the most distinct faces. If they cannot recognize those, they cannot recognize anything else. But when we tested them systematically with chimp faces, they were doing perfectly well on it. And so that's often we have these anthropocentric assumptions which stand in the way of getting at the intelligence of the animals.
How human-centric of us.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Frans de Waal. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah. And nice to have you with us. And the book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. And again, our guest is director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center, also a professor at Emory University in just outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Katie Ricciardi, our intern. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.